Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Kingston Health Sciences Centre is setting new benchmarks in brain tumour care with its Integrative Brain Tumour Program. Kingston Health Sciences Center detailed the program's successful start in a release last week, including dramatic improvements in care, global interest, and the announcement of new funding from the Canadian Cancer Society amounting to $150,000 per year for the next 3 years. Developed under the leadership of Dr. Teresa Persner, a neurosurgeon, researcher, and entrepreneur, this innovative program is achieving best-in-class patient outcomes through a unique blend of academic and entrepreneurial thinking. Dr. Persner shared the program's beginnings and the philosophy behind it in an interview with CFRC. I was wondering if you'd like to just discuss some of the specific differences in the approach of this program compared to how things used to be done that have led to significant improvements in patient outcomes at KHSC.
Yeah, for sure. So I think a big difference with what we did versus traditional academic approaches to problem solving is that we really took more of an entrepreneurial approach. And so the problem that I face, I'm fairly new to Queen's still, so I got here about 3 years ago. And when I came here, I discovered pretty early on that our patients with brain tumors, they were receiving good operations and they were recovering well from the operations, but they were having a tremendously difficult time efficiently navigating the healthcare system afterwards. So I think it's something that most people can relate to in the Canadian healthcare system. It's not always so easy to go from point one to point two. And often things get dropped and lost between you know, important visits and things like that. So I sort of dug into, you know, why is this happening? Is there one specific pain point that's driving all these delays to care? And when I looked into it, there wasn't really one problem. It's just that the entire system was inefficient. And so people with brain tumors, they have to go through quite a few steps, about 16 different steps within the first 2 weeks of their diagnosis. Things like getting CAT scans and MRIs and consultations and surgery and referrals. So they have to get through all of these things, and they were getting small delays at every step. So there wasn't one step that was a huge delay. Every step had small delays. And so cumulatively, it became just a very sluggish system. So when I thought about, you know, how do we solve this? I kind of thought back at, you know, who solves problems, these systemic problems well? And what I'll say is I've spent a lot of time in academia, but also in the entrepreneurial world. And academia is very, very good at identifying and describing problems. So academic approaches are really good at saying, here is the problem, here is a source of inequity, and here are the people suffering from it. Academia is not especially good at then solving that problem. It kind of, the buck ends kind of at finding, discovering, and describing. Whereas in my experience, entrepreneurship or small startups are unbelievably good at identifying specifically what the customer needs, rapidly developing prototypes to meet those needs, and then iterating based on how well their prototypes reflect the needs of the customer. And if a startup can't do that well and meaningfully, it won't survive its first year, right? So it has to survive. It has to be lean, fast, and actually focused on what do people want from me. And so of the two systems, I thought, well, what if we combine them? We'll use the academic approaches to identify the specific problems. But then we can use an entrepreneurial approach to then rapidly solve those problems. And so long story short, the approach we took is an approach called design thinking. It's kind of almost the opposite of the scientific method. So in the scientific method, the scientists come up with a hypothesis, they test it, and then they either reject the hypothesis or they keep it and they publish it. So design thinking is the opposite. We started with no preconceived notions. We went out, we talked to about 43 different people, everything from patients and families to physicians to allied health. And then we also did a deep dive and looked at every pain point of the last 1,500 patients who've had brain tumor surgery. And between those two things, we were able to then design prototypes that reflected those needs, and then launched it like a company, where we launched with all of our new, we have a navigator. She has an email address. We have a website. We have standardized referrals. We have patient education, again, all reflecting the need of that empathize stage. And then went out and tried it. And it, you know, surprisingly, I guess, you know, surprisingly or not, depending on how you look at it, but it's worked really, really well. So for things like time to getting MRI or time to getting radiation, we went from, you know, really pretty low to now almost best in class in a lot of those values. So it's just been very effective.
What are some of the specific changes? I was wondering if you could give us a specific example of a problem that you identified through that consultation process and then how you solved it.
Sure. So I'll give you two very concrete examples. So one thing we noticed is there was a disparity in the outcomes for patients from rural towns, so less than 50,000, versus urban. So if you come from a town of less than 50,000 people, you end up having much lower quality indicator metrics than if you were from a larger town. And interestingly, it's not a matter of being from far away. So someone from a town of 50,000 that's close to Kingston will do worse than someone from, let's say, Peterborough, which is quite a bit further away, but a larger town. And when we looked into, you know, we identified that through the quantitative methods. Then we went and we actually spoke to people from the two different patient demographics and tried to see, you know, what are the differences here? And that, again, gives that very person, that human-centric perspective to quantitative data. And we found a big thing is that people didn't really know once they were discharged from surgery when they should hear from radiation, when they should get the MRI. They didn't really know what was supposed to happen next. And so they weren't able to flag when they were falling between the cracks. And it seemed like people from smaller towns were less likely to advocate for themselves and to come forward and say, hey, why haven't I heard anything, than people from larger towns. And so one way we got around that is we made these patient educational materials, these brochures, walking patients through, okay, here are all the people you're going to meet. This is what you should expect. This is the likely treatment you're going to get, so they can know what's coming. And importantly, in that brochure, we created a timeline where they knew after surgery, this is when you should be hearing from each person. And here are the contact informations if you don't hear from them. So it was a way of empowering the patient to understand what they should, to take away the mystery and honestly, the fear of not knowing what's coming next, and putting the power back in their hands so that they know if they haven't heard, they shouldn't have heard, versus they haven't heard because something has gone wrong, which happens all the time in our system. Another example was that patients would get exceptional care while in hospital. That was a theme that came out in the thematic analysis of all the interviews. They were very happy with the care they received while in hospital. But then once they left hospital, it was as if they were completely on their own and they had no idea what to do. And it's extremely hard to get in contact with your neurosurgeon once you've left the hospital, right? So what we did with the navigator, we created a navigator not only as a unified touch point throughout all the different points of their journey, but we have an email address associated with her as well. And so when someone leaves, if they have a question, something they forgot to ask before leaving, now they can just email the navigator. Well, as before, they really had no effective way of getting answers to those questions other than waiting for the next visit. And what I found surprisingly is that the navigator email is absolutely used, but probably the most impactful part of it is the fact that people have the security of knowing that there is that email address if they need it. And most people don't use it. So those are two examples of just, you know, a combination of quantitative and qualitative insight that resulted in meaningful change for the patient, both in terms of their flow of care, but also the quality of care that they're getting.
Rewinding a bit, what was the timeline there? Did this work start right when you got to Queens 3 years ago, or has this been a shorter process? When did this all start?
It's a great question. It's really new. So it's only been 1 year. So the change happened over 1 year, which is just crazy for healthcare or academia. Nothing happens in 1 year. So 1 year is a long time in a startup's life, right? Mm-hmm. It's make or break. But in academia and healthcare, 1 year is no one expects anything to change in 1 year, really. So we launched it back in January of 2024. And then it's a bit of a soft launch. And then our navigator came on board in August of 24. And that's when we sort of really started formalizing things. So really, it's only been a little over a year. And already we're seeing these sort of outcomes. So, you know, I'm glad the experiment worked.
Since its launch, the Integrative Brain Tumor Program has dramatically improved key metrics in brain tumor care. Notably, the number of patients receiving surgery within provincial targets has increased by over 40%. Delays in radiation therapy have been reduced by 40%, and postoperative MRIs are now performed in a more timely manner for 89% of patients. Brain tumor surgery volumes have surged as more patients are receiving care at KHSC, increasing from 46 patients with primary brain tumors in 2023-24 to a projected 105 patients in 2024-25. Despite its success, getting the program off the ground wasn't without its challenges. What have been some of the biggest challenges you faced while implementing the program?
It's so hard to do truly interdisciplinary work. It's really hard. And a lot of my work has been truly combining different fields because I think it's the best way to get to the most efficient and effective solution. So it works because it makes sense. But it only really makes sense to you in the beginning, right? So if you look at the academic structure, it's really meant to recognize and support things that it's familiar with, right? And so if you think of convincing people to come on board, getting grant funding, executing, getting even institutional support, if you're someone who has always done a good amount of science, it's resulted in predictable outcomes, and you're suggesting you want to do something very similar again, people feel comfortable by that. They recognize that because it's just the same thing, right? And so because you've been successful before, then you'll likely be successful again. They also understand your methods because they're well-established methods. They understand what you're trying to do because it's what other people tried to do before. And so getting institutional support, getting funding, getting even REB approval, things like this, there's a pipeline for it. When you do something that is truly unexpected and developing an academic neuro-oncology program as if it was a startup is truly unexpected. There's no pipeline for you. And it's very, very uncomfortable for people because they don't have a way of assessing whether or not you're going to be successful other than trusting your vision. And it's, there's very limited funding for academia. There's very limited funding in the healthcare system to convince people that it's worth taking that funding and instead of giving it to someone who is more of a sure bet, risking it on you is unbelievably hard. So getting buy-in on every level was very hard. And, it took a lot. The reason it only launched in January versus, year one was because it basically took 2 years of unrelenting advocacy to even give it a shot. And now that it's worked, there's a lot more enthusiasm around it. So it's a lot easier going forward. And we're probably going to go to several other institutions, both, in different countries and within the province in 2025, 26. So now that it's worked, you've overcome that barrier, but oh my gosh, the execution inertia and energy required to do something truly different is unbelievable. And it takes a lot of, you have to have a lot of perseverance, but we got there. And I think the moment that the hospital agreed to give us to fund the Navigator, that was really the turning point where after that, I knew we were going to be successful because it all hinged on that. And we have the absolutely most amazing, wonderful, smart human, a Navigator named Dana. And she's just been so transformative to the program. But when I met her and I knew we were going to partner, I knew it was going to be huge. And one more other shout out I want to give to is Dr. Katie Goldie. She's with the School of Nursing. She's a professor in the School of Nursing. The nursing perspective here was absolutely critical. And so in the early days of the design process, she really provided this valuable nursing perspective, but also she's just an unbelievably intelligent person. So gave her overall insight to the program as well. So it was a battle I fought alongside other people. And I'm just very appreciative that they put their faith in me when really I had no data to support the vision.
With the foundation laid, the program is now poised for thoughtful expansion, according to Dr. Persner. What's next? Where do you see this program going in the near future and beyond?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a question that we can better address now that we have the Canadian Cancer Society funding. That was the second point where I realized that the viability of the project was real. So we're going to expand. I think it's really important to expand thoughtfully and not to blow up too big too quickly. It's another way that startups actually end up kind of shooting themselves in the foot is they get too big too quickly and they can't sustain themselves. So it's important to be very thoughtful. That was the reason why we initially did the program looking at just primary brain tumors, because it's a very manageable population. The next step will first be to expand the diseases. So we're now looking at brain metastasis. Patients in our catchment with brain metastasis have many of the same problems as primary brain tumors, and we haven't addressed that at all at this point. It's only been primary brain tumors. So expanding to other diseases, starting with brain metastasis, and then expanding to different sites. So we're talking very actively with Health Sciences North, so the group in Sudbury, and then we're discussing with a group in Australia. And we're just working out the logistics now of, you know, what does that look like? And it can be anything from just adopting our materials and our pipeline and our live tracker, or it could be as complicated as going through the whole design thinking process themselves and then comparing, you know, the differences and similarities. And of course, I would help really mentor them through that process. But that's our next battle.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, folks. This is Abias from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Today, in this segment, we are joined by Dr. Charlotte Gibson, Assistant Professor and Associate Head of Mining Engineering at Queen's University. With experience across mining industry and research focused on critical minerals, sustainable processing, and machine learning in mining, she brings a unique perspective on the future of resource extraction. We will be talking about her journey from industry to academia and also about her research. Hello, Dr. Gibson. Welcome to Campus Corner. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you for asking. Can you give our audience a quick introduction about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I am an assistant professor and the associate head of the mining department at Queen's University. And in addition to teaching in mining in the area of mineral processing, I have a relatively large research group conducting different sort of lab-based and data-based research in the area of critical minerals processing.
Wow. So let's start from the very beginning. Dr. Gibson, what sparked your interest in mining engineering and critical mineral processing? Was there a moment or experience that led you down this path?
That's a really good question. I think like a lot of high school students today, when I was in high school and choosing what to study in university, I had really no idea about the mining industry or about critical minerals. I actually did my undergraduate degree here at Queen's. So I came to Queen's in the general first year engineering program. And through that, we had a course on geology, which I really enjoyed. And we also had courses in chemistry. And so I found this sort of niche program within mining engineering called mineral processing. And that sort of satisfied both of my interests in both rocks and minerals, as well as chemistry and chemical engineering.
It sounds cool as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I really sort of fell into it, but never really looked back.
Wow, that's such an interesting journey. I want to talk to you about your research, but let's zoom out for a moment because not everyone listening may be familiar with the term. Can you explain or break down what exactly critical minerals are and why have they become such a hot topic in recent years?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And I think the first important thing to note about critical minerals is that most of these critical minerals aren't actually minerals at all. They're elements, so elements from the periodic table. A lot of them are metals, but not all of them are metals. And in Canada, the list of critical minerals is a list. So this is a list of 34 different elements, if you will. And these, in order for an element to be deemed critical according to the Canadian standard, it has to meet two criteria. The first is that it has to have its supply chain threatened. The second is that it has to have reasonable chance or prospect of actually being produced in Canada. So it has to be something that has some sort of risk in its production and something that we actually have here in Canada. In addition to those two criteria, it also has to meet one of the following. So it has to either be essential to Canada's economic or national security, or it needs to be required for our transition to a low carbon economy or a digital economy.
Yeah.
Or it needs to position Canada as a sustainable and strategic partner within global supply chains. So it's a bit of a complex definition, but basically these are elements on the periodic table that we have natural resources of in Canada, that we have some sort of risk in the production, or we need them. They're integral to either our economy, to national security, to our energy transition, or it positions us well within our global supply chain, so with international sort of trading partners.
Wonderful. Your lab is at the forefront of research in this space. So can you tell our audience what is your current research focused on and what problems are you trying to solve?
Yeah, so my research is related to a lot of the upstream processing of these critical minerals. So it's not actually the mining of the minerals, so digging it out of the ground, but the stage that happens after that.
Okay.
So once we mine material, the first step is to physically separate the valuable minerals that contain those critical elements from the material that contains waste or is of no value to us. So these are physical separation processes, but they happen at extremely large scales. So some of these plants will be processing 100,000 or 200,000 tons per day of Wow. rock in order to concentrate those minerals. So within that space, my research is focused on one particular separation process called flotation. And flotation is a highly complex physical separation process where we are taking advantage of differences in mineral hydrophobicity, so their tendency to repel water, in order to actually float them on air bubbles to separate them from minerals that have no value to us. So all of my research falls sort of largely into the category of flotation. And within that, I have a lot of focus on copper, nickel, and lithium minerals.
Wonderful. So since you mentioned lithium, what are the biggest challenges in lithium mineral flotation, and how's your research addressing them?
Yeah, that's a good one. So in lithium flotation, lithium is a really interesting industry because before interest in lithium ion batteries, the lithium market was actually quite small. And what we've seen is that demand for lithium, because of uptake of electric vehicles and the need for sort of battery storage of electricity, the demand for lithium has gone up. And so we are now trying to open and operate new lithium mines all around the world in order to supply this demand. And because of that, a lot of the development of some of these lithium plants has been very fast. And so there's a lot of parts of the process and phenomena that are observed during the process that we don't actually understand fully what's going on. And when we don't understand fundamentally how a process works, when something goes wrong, it becomes very hard to troubleshoot it. So a lot of the work that I do in lithium mineral flotation is related to trying to actually understand something that's happening in an industrial process that we don't know why it happens. We just know that it does happen and here's how we fix it, but we don't know why the fix solves the problem. So it's a very interesting space to be in and a very challenging one.
Wow, that actually sounds very complex. Looking at the next generation students and young professionals, how is Queen's University preparing them for careers in the critical mineral sector?
Yeah, that's a great question. So within Queen's, one of the first and the most important aspects of critical minerals production that we instill and develop in our undergraduate students, starting in first year, and we do this all the way through till they graduate, is environmental and social stewardship. So understanding that the mining industry is obviously a very sensitive one, and it needs to be done responsibly. So this is a very important part of the Queen's mining curriculum. In addition to that, we're teaching a lot of very important technical skills at a very high level. So I believe we are the largest mining school in Canada. And I would, obviously I'm biased, but I think that we are the best mining school in Canada. And so with that comes very, very strong technical skills in our students. And to develop those technical skills and allow our students to sort of apply and see those skills in the real world, we have a few unique features of our program. So one of them is that we take our students on field trips. So all of our second year students once they're in the mining engineering program, we take them to Northern Ontario and actually take them to an underground mine. So they get to go underground and see what that is like. We take them through processing facilities. And we also have them use virtual reality tools in their undergraduate education to give them exposure and some interactive experiences in those remote and hazardous environments that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get through just sort of sitting in a classroom. So through both of these sort of experiential learning opportunities, we're really helping to develop those technical skills.
Amazing. That brings us to the end of this segment. We have touched on Dr. Charlotte Gibson's journey into mining engineering and importance of critical minerals in today's world and here at Queen, but there is still so much more to explore. So Dr. Gibson will be joining us again next Monday to continue this conversation. And that's a wrap, folks. I'm Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment Campus Corner. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, April 16th, a little cooler, 5 degrees with a mix of rain and flurries in the forecast, dropping down to minus 2 overnight. Thursday, April 17th, we're back to the beautiful weather, daytime high of 9 degrees, and it will be sunny, dropping down to 1 overnight. Friday, April 18th, still staying steady at 9 degrees, but a 60% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 4 overnight. Saturday, April 19th, another double-digit day with a 30% chance of precipitation, but it is going to be warm and quite nice otherwise. Sunday, April 20th, sunny with a daytime high of 9. And Monday, one of the nicest days of the year thus far. It's going to be 13 with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reduced load restrictions are still in effect in Kingston. Heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found in the traffic bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, 500 to 472 is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Queen Street, Ontario to King Street East is closed for the dismantling and removal of the tower crane at 18 Queen Street, weather permitting. Berry Street, Queen Street to Colborne is closed for demobilization of equipment at the 283 Queen Street site. And Main Street, Anne to Ellis, is closed to facilitate the installation of a new gas service by Utilities Kingston. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road, Centennial, and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abidon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street to Union Street and Johnson Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Hello everyone, my name is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're going through this week's concerts and events calendars. On Wednesday, Whiskey Smoke will be playing a gig at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Hotel Wolf Island will also be running its usual open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Also on Wednesday, the Kingston Grand, as part of their Grand On Stage series, will have performers of the Classic Albums Live Concert Series playing the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours. This performance starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets available on the Grand's website for around between $44 and $55. Frank Ryan is also scheduled to play Wednesday night between 8 and 11 at Musiki. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at The Buckle from 8 to 11 p.m. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is scheduled to perform at the Isabel Bader at 7:30 Thursday evening. Tickets for said performance are available for between $15 and $35 on the Isabel's website. Also on Thursday, three bands, B.A. Johnston, Owl Farm, and The Strange Happenings, will be playing at The Mansion. Tickets for the show, starting at 9 p.m., are available for around $10 on Ticketscene or for $15 at the door. The Toucan also has some live performers lined up for Thursday night, with Sarah Jane Riley and Dylan Ireland performing from 9:10 to 1 as part of their Rules for the Collective Good tour. After that, on Friday, band Cheyenne Twink will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory. The show, starting at 7:30, has tickets available on Ticketscene for around $25. Also on Friday, the blues/rock group Hellhound Trail will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. On Saturday, Frank Ryan is on to play a set or two at Tiernanog from 7 to 9. The Boo Radley Project will also be returning to the Toucan Saturday night for a show running from 10:30 to 2. Also Saturday night, the Marion Drexler Band will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8. On Sunday, Neil Carter will be performing a collection of classics at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5. And later on, Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki from 4:30 to 6:30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendars. On Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. Also on Wednesday, One Eye Jacks will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7, and both Something in the Water and Daft Ruin will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Daft will host Queerioki from 8 to 11. Folks can also head to the Kingston Public Market, which is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. The Kingston Spring Night Market will also be running at Memorial Center from 4 to 8 p.m. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group will be hosting its usual public run this Thursday, starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, The Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD students will be giving a free talk in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. Folks can also head down to participate in Runner's Choice East End Run Group at 7:50 a.m. at the Canets Kingston Supermart, 29 Niagara Park. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Do you have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concerts and events calendars? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. I have been Henry, CFRC intern for the Queen's Department of History, and this has been my last broadcast of the concert and events calendars updates. Someone else will be taking over soon. I hope everyone listening has a nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.